Let's go ahead and get started. I know people are still coming in. Time is of the essence here. My amazing assistants, Drew and Jared, are passing out pieces of scrap paper for you to write any questions on that you might have as this class time together proceeds. And if you need pens, let them know too. We've got some extras that they're bringing along as well. So please go ahead and take a seat, preferably closer here, because if you hear a slight cold in my voice, it is there. That's why I'm bumping elbows this morning and not shaking hands. But I'm grateful to be healthy enough to be here. As this is happening, I'd like you to listen to some words from Psalm 27. We'll start with that, from Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? One thing I ask of the Lord, and that do I seek, to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. For in the day of trouble, he will keep me safe in his dwelling. He will hide me in the shelter of his sacred tent and set me high upon a rock. And then my head will be exalted above the enemies who surround me. At his sacred tent I will sacrifice with shouts of joy. I will sing and make music to the Lord. And then this prayer, a few verses later. Do not turn me over to the desire of my foes, for false witnesses rise up against me, spouting malicious accusations. I remain confident of this, that I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. And then from Psalm 32, verses 6 and 7. Therefore, let all the faithful pray to you while you may be found. Surely the rising of the mighty waters will not reach them. And then this prayer. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. Now, these two psalm readings are expressions of a powerful theme in the Bible called sanctuary. And sanctuary includes physical space, but it's more than that. It's also something very central to the very nature and character of God. God offers the sanctuary of mercy and renewal and regeneration to us sinful sons and daughters of Adam who would otherwise flee from God's holiness and fear. So in a way, even the cross of Jesus Christ is the ultimate expression of God's sanctuary nature, sanctuary disposition towards us. But also in the Old Testament, there was something in the rituals and the architecture of the temple and the tabernacle that also expressed God's sanctuary nature. And one of the prime ones is the very sacrificial altar, which had like four horns on at each corner of that altar. And if someone was accused of a crime, especially something like murder, and they were being pursued, say, by vigilantes, they could run to that altar and grab a couple of those horns and hang on there. And that brought the whole chase, the whole pursuit thing to a halt so that there was time to let tempers cool down and investigate the situation, see if this person was really innocent or not. And if the person was not innocent and was lying, sanctuary was withdrawn, but it was a way of giving space. And there's a way, too, within our congregation. Yes, we have a physical sanctuary here, but also the mutual aid and the pastoral care that we extend to each other, the expressions of support that we give each other are also a kind of sanctuary because they give us a refuge from just the coldness and the hostility and the difficulty and condemnation and constant judgment going on in our life and in our world. So let's take a moment just to pause and pray for this meeting and draw upon that very sanctuary nature of God on our behalf. Let's pray. Lord, you are our hiding place. And at various times we've had to call to you for mercy and help. More than we know, we draw upon your mercy for every beat of our hearts. Lord, we pray also on behalf of those whose cries for mercy and sanctuary have come to us, and guide us by the presence of your Spirit in this physical sanctuary as we hear this call and consider our response. Amen. And now just a little more introduction to what brings us here together. To talk about sanctuary in a day like this may sound very, very political, but I do not want to convey any kind of judgment about how anyone voted recently or who you voted for or if you voted or not, because the crisis long precedes the last election and was actually intensifying in a previous administration. But there has recently been the White House executive order that aims, among other things, to hire 10,000 additional Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents throughout the whole country. So you know Rhode Island is not going to get 200 of them. And these people will be out there to seek out and round up and deport undocumented immigrants. And also in that executive order is a guideline that says that any crime, whether it is proven in a court of law or simply an indictment or an accusation, is grounds for the deportation of any undocumented person, including the crime of being here. And that explains the recent surge of arrests and deportations, even of people with no history of violent crime. And I'm not aware that those parts of the executive order are up for debate in a federal court. And then there's this bigger policy evolution, you could call it, over the past 16 years, ever since September 11, 2001, that treats immigration more and more and more as a matter of national security and the fight against terrorism rather than, say, simply a diplomatic thing. So it's increasingly all in all about our fear of terror and security, those who are already here, and less about the security needs and the terror of people who come here. Before 2001, the immigration system tried to balance those security needs. So those are some of the concerns that have brothers and sisters in the churches coming to us concerned as never before, looking for help. And yes, it is true, there are drugs and thugs crossing our country's borders. If that were all of it, if that were the whole picture, then Romans 13 and the mandate of the state to protect the innocent would be all we'd have to think about. But the majority of people crossing our borders, legally or otherwise, looking to stay, are themselves the innocent whom their government failed to protect or whom their government even is attacking. Many of them are desperately poor, simply looking for work and a chance to survive. But many of them are also, or instead, are fleeing the corruption and cruelty of drug cartels and government corruption and collusion. So the terror and the poverty often go hand in hand. Most of the attention has been on Mexico, but now the person crossing the U.S. border is likely to be a single mother, say from Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras. Her husband was perhaps killed by drug cartel, and her 14-year-old son was told, you join us or we kill you too. So she shows up and crosses the border with a coyote, someone who leads her and others here. And fairly often, she will run right to the immigration agents and ask for asylum here. But if she knows just how unresponsive and adversarial the immigration system now is, if she knows how terrible the detention centers are, if she knows how backlogged the whole asylum process is, then more likely she's going to sort of disappear into the underground economy and work for pitiful poor wages at the mercy of whoever puts her to work. Or there are other people I've known from other places, such as Djibouti in East Africa or the Democratic Republic of Congo, who need to flee quickly. And they know they have a better chance of getting asylum in, say, Quebec or Belgium or France, but by the time they can get a visitor's visa there, they're dead. They can get a visitor's visa to the United States much more quickly, but they know it might take forever or never to get asylum here. I mean, I know of one person whose case just got lost and forgotten by the Immigration Service. So if it turns out that they're denied asylum and their only choice is they're going to be sent back to their country where the death squad awaits them, That's another reason they might just disappear into the underground economy and try to stay low. So the people who are looking for asylum or sanctuary are not terrorists. Most of them are not drug trafficking thugs. They're some of the members and leaders of our partner churches in our conference. They serve us coffee or they cook our meals at restaurants. Their children may be attending school with our children and grandchildren. And I can say, Becky and I can say from experience that we've seen how sometimes they bring that same entrepreneurial energy and skill and organization that got them here and that courage, they've used that to revitalize many parts of our communities and our economies. And apart from being here technically, illegally, the best study shows that their crime rate is actually lower than the general overall population because it was crime that often drove them out of their own countries. So now they and their partner and our partner agencies like Mennonite Central Committee, Mennonite Church USA, Bridging Cultures, Canby, and others are asking us to hear their cry for due process of law, even for sanctuary of some kind or another, whether it's a sanctuary of our hearts or our relationships or even of space, and to discern, hear this call and to discern what we are going to do in response. And when I say sanctuary, yes, you might think of a physical space like this church building. The advantage of that is it's a place that immigration and customs enforcement agents are usually reluctant to cross. They call this a sensitive area. But there's no guarantee that these next new 10,000 ICE agents would observe that nicety. But let's also consider other ways, too, that we can be a sanctuary people, if that's what God is calling us to do, and other ways that we can do it. And let's just a brief review of what Zion Mennonite Church and its members are already doing as kind of like a sanctuary people. And one is that we are partnering and supporting agencies and ministries that build relationships among people of different cultures and with immigrants, like Bridging Cultures, the Jubilee Food Shelf, the ESL classes that happen here and elsewhere. And I imagine you can think of a few more. Zion is offering a budget line item of, what, someone helped, 883 or so far, to help immigrants working on paperwork, like, for example, getting American passports for their U.S.-born children. And then also we participate in a regional district conference that includes churches with members who are undocumented and also some church leaders who are in various stages and states of immigration status. I think we've got some things to project. And what's the first one here? Okay, this is MCUSA's recommendations to us. And I'll just read them as you can see them up there. And one is, this is the call of our denomination, to educate ourselves cross-culturally and about immigration issues, to have Bible studies, sermons, etc., on immigration issues and hospitality. We've done a bit of that. Advocate to state, local, and federal authorities on behalf of humane immigration policies and reform. Offer church facilities for human services, ESL classes, cultural celebrations, after-school tutoring, etc. There's a lot that could go into etc. We do ESL classes and things like that here. Some additional MCUSA recommendations. Educate ourselves about political and economic causes of immigration realities on the U.S.-Mexico border. Don and Kelly will be going on a Borderlands tour sponsored by Mennonite Central Committee in April. There are some more MCC tours coming up later in the year, and for some young adults, the elders and I would like to let you know that we are offering some of that scholarship money for that as well. Pray for humane immigration reform and all who are caught up in the system. Support and accompany people as they work through the immigration system. And speaking personally, I have done that, and it's very educational to sit in a lawyer's office. I've helped translate and gone to court hearings. It's very eye-opening. Build relationships with immigrants and immigrant churches advocate for a fair and living wage for all, and the reason for that is that undocumented people are very much vulnerable to exploitation. I have had techeros, people who work on roofing crews, you know, come and say, I can't pay groceries this week, can you help me? Because the boss just decided that he wasn't going to pay me this week, and what could I do about it? Plan and join ecumenical and interfaith activities and advocacy on behalf of immigration justice. Let's see, what's the next slide that we have up there? Okay, that's for bridging cultures. I want to do something else here. I want to, somehow or other, we didn't get the MCC ones to project here. So could I have my amazing assistants come forward here, please, to pass these out? Jared and, okay. But as they're passing these out, I will read what's there. And as I'm doing this, feel free to take a moment to write down any questions that come to mind, because then later they'll go around with baskets to collect them. Some of the things that MCC requests are financially support MCC's ongoing humanitarian relief and peace-building projects. It says here that helps Syrians displaced in Syria and Iraqi refugees. But generally speaking, when you hear people say, you know, it's best if we help people to stay in their own country, that's generally true, unless they're targeted personally for execution or torture or something like that. But MCC and other agencies, when they can, want to help people stay in their home countries or near enough to their home countries to be able to go back someday. And that is the ideal, but it's not often possible. And most immigrants who come here undocumented would rather have stayed in their own countries too. So doing what we can also to help MCC with that is very valuable. Secondly, support the immigration education work of MCC. Contact your government representatives to oppose efforts to halt the resettlement of refugees based on religion or nationality, as well as any efforts to reject, detain, or deport asylum seekers. Four, support churches and families resettling Syrian families in Canada throughout MCC Canada. Well, that's for Canadians. MCC was not able to do that in the U.S. here recently. Form a congregational welcome team for refugees settling in the U.S., working with one of these church agencies, which have cooperative agreements with the U.S. Department of State. And I know that's part of Zion's history, that has been done several times here. And we did look into that recently, but we could not get a firm commitment to help people settle in a place like Canby as opposed to Portland. Become a sanctuary congregation for families in danger of being deported from the U.S., or support families in sanctuary at other locations. Congregations around the country are offering their churches as places of refuge for families in danger of being deported while they await due legal process. Now, that is a fairly extreme step, but I recently read in the New York Times where, in the current climate of immigration, some lawyers are actually telling their immigration clients, find a church that can hide you. So it's come to that point. And seven, pray that God will stir people's hearts to compassion for all people around the globe who are forced from their homes by war, disaster, and economic hardship. Now, prayer is not listed here as the least thing we can do. Prayer is important, and I hope that would sort of soak and permeate everything we do and discern. Jana, I wonder if you would come here and tell us about bridging cultures and bridging cultures request and call to us. That's what we have on the... That will be the next thing to project, please.
Bridging Cultures is planning to have Passport Night on April 22nd, and what proposes to is, I need to use my glasses, to sponsor one kid or more with $25 each passport. It's not a full price or form relationship with families or immigrants. We have our events in Locust Park. Our first event will be May 20. Everybody can go and spend a little time with families there. Offer to be guardians for children of deportees. Be on first responder team for families of deportees. And I don't know if Waldo can help me to explain a little more about this. Thank you.
Yeah, and when you come, please, yeah. Okay. Janet, a quick question. Would you tell us the importance of, what is the importance of the passports for the children?
Okay,
what is the importance? Aquí está la importancia de los pasaportes para los niños.
Okay, many of families, they have children to need to have passport in case and they get deported. If they have passport already, it's more easy to take children with them. Okay, in separate way, but it's more easy if they start prepare themselves with passport, with power attorney, and the custody for children and in case they get deported.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Okay, and Wendell, would you like to, is there more you want to add to that, as well as, would you like to tell us about Sihan's statement? Sihan, I should say. Well, yeah, tell us who Sihan is, and then what they're asking for. And the next slide, please.
Sihan is the Council of Anabaptist Churches of the Northwest, and I'm the district pastor for the Mennonite Conference for those churches. I pastor the pastors. And in a recent council meeting about 2 weeks ago, the council named a commission to work on immigration events to represent churches and come up with a plan. So I was named as part of that commission. And here is the response from the commission to the churches, primarily to the Hispanic churches, but to all of the Mennonite churches. We first recognized that facing the political challenges in the country, the church can't offer a solution for our immigrant families, but we recommend these actions in our churches to prepare and defend our families facing the threat of mass deportations. And first is prayer. Together, let us cry out to God to give strength to his people so that we do not give ground to fear and desperation. That is ground, bottom line. All of our churches, all of our prayer meetings, pastors have expressed to me that that is what people are fighting with. The fact that they are powerless to resolve their situation, and fear and desperation cause people to make bad decisions and lose hope. Number two, declaration. Let us confess our needs to one another in the church so we can support each other openly and in solidarity. When I speak with Anglo persons, they often find it surprising to know that in Hispanic churches, we don't talk about this. It's each person's problem. It's a very private, sometimes shameful question. And it's very difficult for people to talk about it in the group. But pastors are calling people in the church to declare this openly. This is my family's situation. This is my family's problem. I need you to pray for me. I need you to help me. That allows the other people in the church to respond openly and not covertly. Number three is preparation. Let us encourage and help families to get passports for their children, whether that be American citizen children or Mexican, or as a pastor just told me yesterday, I read the list and you didn't mention Guatemalan children, Honduran children, Salvadoran children. There are people from many other countries, not just Mexico. And to encourage and help parents to designate guardians for the care of their children in case of emergency. We, the church, will look for resources for those who do not have them. There are many families who do not have enough resources to get the documents that it is possible to get them, which would be passports. And number four is organization. Let us organize phone networks of first responders for aiding our families in the moment of emergency. And that would be helping people with child care, helping people with information to get attorneys, how to contact their detained loved ones when they're deported to Tacoma, transportation, all those things that come up in the moment of an emergency. When we presented this suggested place of beginning to the pastors at a recent meeting, this was the pastor's response. And these responses go especially to pastors, but to the whole church. One pastor said, "Churches, it's time to wake up from the American dream. We belong to the kingdom of God." One pastor said, "Pastors need to preach and teach against fear and for faith in action. It's not simply enough to mention the situation, but pastors need to encourage and preach against fear and for action. Pastors need to be ready to represent their detained church members with letters of recommendation or personal appearances. Go to the ICE detention center. Go to court for your members."
Thank you. Again, just a little background. If those 10,000 new immigration and customs enforcement agents, if that money was instead being put to 10,000 people to work on asylum application backlogs and catching up with all the disorganized and backlog stuff in the immigration system, again, we'd be holding a celebration here this morning rather than a meeting like this. I'd like to take a little bit of time for questions, but first of all, again, I'll ask our assistants to go around. I've got some baskets here. If you have a question that you just sort of want presented on paper, you don't have to put your name to it, then they'll collect it. But if anybody has a question that you'd like yourself personally bring to the whole group, in a minute we can do that too. I'll bring the microphone around for that.
A brother last night was saying, this is not a situation only for the undocumented, but for anybody of color. If we look foreign, we've got to have our documents on us to show that we are citizens. So that it's not just to the undocumented, this fear, but it's also to anybody of color.
Thank you. Any other questions? I can come around if you want to ask. And to back up what you said there, Karen, I had lunch on Tuesday with Pastor Samuel Moran of the Hispanic Mennonite Church in Portland, and he shared the same thing, that everyone with any kind of immigration status, documented or not, is feeling the fear. Let's go with some of the questions here. How can pastors, who also happen to be illegal, go to court to help their constituents? Wendell, you got some ideas on that? None. Okay. Not. Okay. Okay, so if they happen to be, because what? You're saying that they cannot go there. Would it be because of risk of detention themselves?
Okay. So in that case, the pastor needs to find another representative of the congregation, an elder, a deacon, someone else who can accompany the person.
Okay. Thank you. And it used to be that courtrooms themselves were also among those sensitive areas that people should not be picked up and detained in, but that has changed of late. Oh, sure, yes.
I work as a court interpreter, most of you know, and my experience in the last 4 months has been that three of my clients have been whisked out from underneath my nose right outside the courtroom. So, and the public defense attorneys were totally clueless. They didn't know what was going on until the person was gone, basically. So, of no help. That was a very distressing experience, as you can imagine. But it also caused defense attorneys to no longer tell people, "Don't be afraid to come to your hearing. If in the courthouse, you will not be bothered." Attorneys can no longer tell their clients that, because at some point, I don't know how many months ago this was. It was already 3-4 or more months ago. ICE evidently began to pick up people on the computers. All court records are public, so they can find anyone's name who has any proceeding in court and wait for them just outside the courtroom.
Thank you, Wendell. Another question. What does being a guardian signify? And I'll start a little bit on that. In other words, let's say that there is a raid and the parents are picked up and detained and deported because they don't have status here. But let's say the children are born here. And so the children are not picked up and sent back. They're not to be sent back. So let's say DHS takes them. DHS has to determine where are these children going to go. But if there are some legal notarized documents that say, we, the parents, want these children to go to so-and-so and so-and-so, then hopefully DHS will take that into consideration. I don't think it's a requirement that they do, but hopefully they will take that into consideration. I was a little shocked earlier when I saw that request too, thinking, has it come to the point where parents have to think seriously about where they would be and their children would be across national borders? And yes, but often the guardianship that is in mind is temporary, not permanent necessarily. That the parents, if they're sent back to Guatemala or Mexico, will still need time to set up a new life and at some point hopefully be able to say, now bring the kids here. We've got a safe place. We've got school for them or something like that. Is that correct or am I leaving it? Okay. So it does mean taking legal guardianship or at least offering it for someone. Can we pass this down to Charlie, please?
There's a form that could be filled out and we're going to be working on it probably in April sometime. Having people come that are interested in doing that. It's not, what I understand, it doesn't need to be notarized, but it is a form that needs to be filled out ahead of time, and there will be lawyers there to explain what that means and how that affects you as the person, and it lasts for 6 months. That's the long as that could go on. It's an agreement for you to watch and be responsible for some of the decisions that the children have for the 6 months and try to get them reunited with their parent.
Thank you. And one of the things that guardianship implies or encourages is that we have a relationship with the family and the children so that we are not perfect strangers to the family. And again, as Janet mentioned, Bridging Cultures activities is a chance to start those relationships. Another one that I'm fuzzier on is this question, good one. Why passport for parents' country of origin? Would not just an American passport be valid for going to join the parents in, say, Guatemala or El Salvador? Why also then a Mexican or Salvadoreño or Congolese passport for that matter? Yes, Wendell.
Because if the family lives permanently in Mexico or Guatemala, and their children are American citizens who have come on a tourist visa across the border, after 3 months, they become illegal aliens in the country of their parents. And a lot of those families will be living in small villages a long way away from any place that they could get to an American consulate. So it becomes more difficult for them to work on getting residency in that country as American citizens than it would be to get it here.
Thank you. So that is so that the children, once they join the family back in their parents' country, will not themselves be finally illegal aliens. Now, that explains something else that, from my own family's history, I have seen my grandfather's, grandmother's documents where my father's birth in 1935 or so was registered at a Polish consulate in Germany, which means that after Hitler had come into power, my grandfather was thinking, maybe I better take the family to Poland, where his ethnicity and relatives were. First responder training information. Good question. So I think someone is asking, how do we get training for being first responders, not go into a difficult, chaotic, heart-rending situation without training? Anybody got any ideas on that one? I hadn't thought of that. That's a good question. Charlie.
We at Bridging Cultures have talked this a lot of times. Nobody's picked up that interest, but if there is a group, three or four from this church that would like to say, hey, that's something I'd like to do, that's something we can get you trained and get lawyers to work with you and make up a plan so that when something like that happens in our community and we have somebody that we're alerted to that can alert that group of people that want to do that, they can go to work immediately on it. 24/7. So anybody's interested in that, we have a lot of things we're working on Bridging Cultures, but we need more help. And that's one area if you're interested in, and there's three or four of you want to really get educated on what you need to do. We've been involved in those kind of situations, but not really had a task force. And it really would be nice to have three or four in this community that when that happens, that number is called and you go to task and figure out what's going on. You'll know what's going on, but be educated and know how to help the family.
So what do first responders do typically after doing, like in response to a rape?
Well, when that happens, the family notifies once one of their members is gone. You go to task finding out where that person's being detained at, and then you find out if they have legal advice, that kind of information, make sure the family's got what they need to, or the children that are left, or whatever they need to do to cope with their situation they're in. So it's just an emergency group that comes in and figures it out. It's different for every situation.
The first responder group may also be the ones who notify if the children are at school and don't know anything about it, who can go and pick them up?
Yeah.
Who can contact their guardians or next of kin if parents are not there and help make those decisions. There's another part about first responders, and that is part of what the Hispanic churches were asking about first responders is for people to be there and carry their cell phones. That's our new arm. It's our new weapon. We don't have to march anymore. We just have to publish. That's the way it's working. So if there are people who are there and can document and post, that's a powerful thing.
So a question I had was, with this increased enforcement by ICE, is having Bridging Cultures meals in a Canby City Park going to be seen as a scary place or a threatening place potentially versus outside the church? I mean, that's just a question I see, is if they're going to courtyards, why wouldn't they go to a gathering in the center of Canby where there's potentially lots of people, which I could see people not wanting to go because of that threat?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. That's a good question. Yeah. Any other questions here? Yes, Pat.
Just a comment, and I don't want to shift us from the community that desperately needs friends and advocates. We once upon a time were employers, and you accept the documents that you receive. You do not question those. That's all you need to do. We have employers in the congregation who possibly may employ people. We as a community of faith what do we do here? What is our walk alongside as well? And I think some of our economy in this area is going to really notice a workforce shift.
Thank you. And that brings up another point in which we are involved, and that is as employers, business people. Any other questions? Well, what I've just passed out for you are some question sheets about what are we willing to do that I offer for you to look at and reflect on. And at great risk, I put a lot of things on it that are possibilities for responses that I'd like us to take some time now, maybe about 10 minutes to look at and maybe mark these. If you want to put your name on them, then you can, or maybe you don't have to. And I'd like to collect these. But if you like another copy to keep so as you can think about it, then we'll make sure you get one maybe right after we collect these. And I'd just like to bring your attention to a few of the things there. Number one is pray on behalf of all and involved and affected. And this is not to say that prayer is the least of things we can do, but it is the basis and part of everything. At the very last, there are two questions. Number 16, other ideas for action and involvement in immigration-related activities. And that's for you to write on things that have not been thought of or mentioned here. Number 17 is a perfectly valid one, too, that we need to hear. When I am not willing to participate in any of the church-sponsored immigration-related activities mentioned above, and I have the following questions, concerns, or objections about them. This is not meant as a session to railroad people into doing something that they have questions about. So if you have any of those kinds of questions, concerns, or objections, we want to hear them as well. And then 18, for anything else you would like to say, any other questions, comments, or concerns that you would have. This would be a place to write them as well. But the others, hopefully they're clear. If they're not, raise your hand as you're reading through this, and I'll come around to see if I can explain my writing. But I'll give you this time now to go ahead and think about these questions here and fill them out. Okay, would you clarify that question, please?
So we're wondering if number two, what exactly that means, if it includes anything, including like writing letters, calling representatives, like what does that involve?
So the question number two, does advocacy, yes, letters, phone calls, a visit, showing up at a town hall meeting, whatever else, whatever kind of advocacy is. It'll make sense to you, and you can do.
I don't know if it would help anybody else to understand number nine better, but when I went to that immigration meeting with Bridging Cultures, I didn't understand the residency with a driver's license piece, and that helped me to understand why people can't drive. If somebody wants to explain that to the group, I can't explain it as well as probably somebody else can, but explain why you can't have an Oregon driver's license and why you end up being illegal because of it.
The basic reason is because of the change in Oregon policy that now requires you have to have a valid Social Security number in order to get a driver's license. That's, I believe, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I'm not sure how many years, but that's the basic reason why most persons who do not have legal permanent resident status cannot get a driver's license, because when you get legal permanent residency, then you get a Social Security number. The exception to that would be young persons who have gotten registered under Obama's DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So there are thousands of young people who have gotten, basically it's a what they call a stay. It means the government knows you're here, but the government promises that if you register, they won't deport you during this period of time. So those persons can get a work permit and they can get a driver's license, although they don't actually have a Social Security number. That would be the only exception to that.
Thank you. Here, Steve, why do you?
Just wanted to add, F and H-1 visas should, I think, follow that category as well. Pardon? F is mainly for students and H is for workers.
Thank you. Yeah, feel free to ask any other questions about these possibilities. Yes, Ward.
Washington and got driver's license earlier, is that still a possibility?
That's the problem.
It is a possibility, but that is possible as long as the police do not pull you over and ask you where you are currently living. If it is more than 30 days since you got your license from Washington, the police consider that to be an invalid license and they will take it away. So that's the situation for many persons who moved to Washington temporarily, got residency in Washington, got a license in Washington, maintained their work in Oregon, but moved back to Oregon with a Washington license. And many of them are losing them because of that currently.
Thank you. Yes, Jody.
On the back, number 14 and 15, should Zion come to the point where Zion is offering sanctuary within our own building, or if a family is offering sanctuary within our own house, at what risk? What is going to happen if someone were to do that?
That's a good question, and that would have to be taken into account. The question is, at what risk would there be either to the church or any hosts hosting undocumented people? Does anyone have any history or any knowledge of that? Yeah, I personally don't know, and that is a very important question that needs to be addressed. I remember the sanctuary movement in the early 1980s when people were fleeing from Guatemala and El Salvador, Nicaragua, the civil wars there, and they could not get asylum in the U.S. because U.S. policy was allied with the forces that were driving them out. And so there were some churches that offered sanctuary. I'm not aware that there were any legal punishments or repercussions for them at that time, but I imagine there could possibly be legal or financial risks. There certainly would be certain costs involved, like refitting a place, a physical space to actually host people. But I think what would be the risk, how a government or a police department would respond, or how ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, would respond, or what the repercussions, what the risk would be beyond, to say to tax-exempt status or criminal record. Those are, I think that's going to be a work in progress yet. Yes.
Is there any idea of what the cost is for each of these steps that families, parents that are illegal, children that were born here, what is the cost to get everything in order? Is there any idea what that is? How expensive is this for these people?
such as cost of the paperwork, cost of the passport? Who can answer that for us? Actual financial cost of these various legal steps.
The cost of the passport, that's a pretty easy question. We've got a whole list of different passports for different ages. I mean, for adults, a passport costs $110. Children, it's $60. You can also get a card passport, not a book passport. That will get you across a land border. It's like an ID card. You can go to Canada or Mexico, but not on the plane. You can cross the land border. And that's much less expensive. That's only passport card for child is 60. No, 25. Okay. They break it down into three different things you have to pay separately. So 15 plus 25 plus 15. So what is that, 40? Yeah. So that would be that's the cheapest possible passport that you can get for a child. It will only get you across the border. Yeah, 110 plus 20, 110 plus 25 plus 15. That's for an adult. That's the 15. Yeah, 15 is the picture, 25 is the application, and 110 is the passport book. So. Yeah, I think it's about the same price. To get a passport from Mexico.
Notarized papers and stuff?
If you are a client of a bank, they will usually offer you to notarize a paper without charge. If you're not, that runs usually $10 or $15 to get a document notarized.
Thank you. Well, Carolyn, does that help some with the question? It's getting fairly complicated depending on what we do.
How many of these cases need an attorney or legal assistance?
How many of these cases need legal assistance? A lot of them, or?
Did you get a passport? No.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, for getting passports, no attorney help is needed, but for guardianship.
For guardianship, for most families, if there's no special conditions, attorneys often pass out standard forms where the parents just sign and the legal guardians sign that they accept. And that's basically a suggestion. It's not... You know, they're not handing over their children for adoption. It's a suggestion to DHS workers, because DHS workers are required to first look for next of kin or the persons that the parents prefer before they look for other options. So if the parents haven't said anything, DHS finds whoever they can find. But if the parents have stated their preference for a relative or another person, DHS is required by their internal protocol to look at that first. So that's really the question. I mean, if there's some other legal difficulty, I mean, that family might need to consult with an attorney before they do that.
So because of that, bridging cultures, one of the things we're going to do is have lawyers available to handle some of that and just answer questions. No, they don't need to be there. But at our events, yeah, so that, like on the April event we're planning. And then the post office, we're trying to work with them before we got the post office to come to Cambie and to the school and do the Well, they're having a hard time doing that. But I found one sympathetic ear the other day, and she said, well, if you bring a busload of people up on a Saturday, maybe I'll open up. And she said, I'll see what I can do to open up the office so it makes it easier for people to get their passport and their work done. So we're working at that. You know, but the answers could be all different. I mean, as far as, but it's good to have legal advice, you know, and we'll provide it at our events. So if people do have questions, regardless of whether they want to be a family that takes another family in or a parent that wants to give the power of attorney to somebody else, all those answers will be given and it'll be done so that everybody feels good about it.
I have a question. If Zion will set up a account special for the passport money, so if people want to donate, it's going to be separate from donation to the church.
Ursula, you're asking about a financial account to contribute to help people with that. We actually did that at this last business meeting where we moved some money from one fund, I think it was from the dental van fund, over to that very purpose. But we recognized also that it might need to be contributed to. And so it is available. So, yes, there is such a fund, Ursula. Thanks for asking about that. One other thing I want to point out is that we are getting, as you heard from Janet, Janet, you know, Bridging Cultures is giving some hands and feet to the administration of that money with a proposal that, yes, gives money from Zion Mennonite Church, but also requires money, skin in the game financially, from the people who apply for that. So it's not just given totally as though it's just charity care, but it's a partnership. And I appreciate that philosophy. Yes, Andy, okay. Okay, we'll get back to you. Okay.
So what we did is we actually set up a designated giving line item fund or whatever, so that way if you do decide you want to give some money toward this, it's the immigrant fund, I think we called it, and so it's a designated fund in our line. So it's not a budgeted item, but it's just a designated. So if you decide you want to give extra and on your check in the memo line, we just write immigration fund, that would go into that particular fund.
Thank you. Andy, and then Karen.
I hesitate to speak just because Yannette and Wendell and Charlie are so much more knowledgeable about this stuff. We're working with them. Yannette is going to come to the Jubilee Food Pantry on the 17th and speak with the folks there. The $700 that we typically use for the medical teams international has been shifted over. And we went, Wendell and Karen and Serenity and I sat down and kind of mapped out our plan for how we were going to use those funds. And we've decided to, we have obviously a smaller group of folks that come to the food pantry compared to Bridging Cultures. So what we're looking at is the $700, or I think that's how much it is, of giving $50 towards either a card or a passport. Folks would have to get their own picture and bring it, you know, saying that they've made some steps towards getting their passports or their cards. And as far as like being reimbursed or if we're going to take them to the post office, those are still things we're kind of working on. So that $700, if we're donating $50 towards each child that we're trying to get the passport or the card for, that's going to go through about 14 children. So once we kind of begin working through this process with the folks that go to the food pantry, we'll know if we have 30 kids, how many more, you know, donations we need. So I know I don't want to compete with other organizations that are doing the same thing. But basically we're going to try to do the rounds with all seven of our covenant congregations and speak to them about the situation and what our heart is and how we want to show solidarity with folks. I would throw one more thing out there, and I've done it before too, so this isn't a condemnation on anyone that's speaking or asked questions, but the term illegal is a term that we can eliminate from our vocabulary if we want to show solidarity with folks. Simply undocumented, I think, is a much more appropriate term to use. And in that, it says that, you know, because crossing the border is not a crime, it's a misdemeanor. And so when we talk about criminals, nobody here who is quote-unquote illegal is a criminal in this country. And so we can show solidarity a lot of times by eliminating the language of empire and embracing a language of kingdom talk. And I would just encourage us to maybe, and I do it all the time as well, so to kind of, you know, transition into using that term undocumented instead of illegal. So.
Thanks, Andy. Drew and Jared, would you go ahead and start collecting papers from those who are ready to give them up? And if you're still working on it, feel free to stick them under my door after church, or put them in the church, my church mailbox or something like that. Karen?
I'm wondering, I really am, it's so outrageous, and I don't know how to effectively pressure the government. I see that this mcc.org/immigration maybe has options for how to contact officials, but does anyone have something that they've used that seems to be good and up to date and specific about who and how to contact?
Did you get that? Anyone have any insight or experience on advocacy that you have found helpful for us? Well, that's kind of an answer, isn't it? Yes, right. Okay. Clark. Louise.
The MCC Washington office often puts out, where do I see it? Is it coming in an email, maybe? They'll have things for action and suggestions for what to say in a telephone call or that kind of thing. If you check with the MCC USA office, that's one resource.
I called that number on MCC's website, the White House, and left a message. And so that's available to anybody. It's a toll-free number. And then also I think it's important just to support, even though our representatives probably represent what we believe anyway, I think it's important to let them know that they do. I mean, that there are people that, to encourage them to keep on doing what they're doing.
Thank you. I think we'll need to bring this to a close here since worship starts in about 10 minutes. But I do believe that hearing, you know, the Lord hears the cries of the poor, says the Psalms. And when we hear it, that is a part of worship as well. And then later on in the worship service today, we'll hear even more of what Jesus says about how our disposition toward each other and towards those in need and our disposition toward God go hand in hand. So thanks for the time that you have spent on this, or will continue to spend as well. And Jana and I and all the members of pastoral leadership team will continue to welcome your continued thoughts and response. And if from your response we get a strong sense of something to do, then I think we'll probably then bring it to whatever appropriate committee is there, and maybe even to church council. I suppose I should have warned Kevin, and see where we go from there. Please join me again in prayer. Lord, you are our refuge and our sanctuary. It is you, O Lord, who have called us into being and who also equip us with the gift of your Spirit for the building of your body mutually all throughout the world, for people of every tribe, tongue, and nation across all cultures and centuries. And Lord, we pray that from our deliberations and care and the wisdom that your Spirit gives, we may indeed display the manifold beauty of your body, the church, rich and poor of every culture, helping each other. Lord, help us to hear the cries of the poor as do you. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.